Welcome back to the Better Places podcast, the show where we explore the people, projects and ideas shaping the future of our towns, cities and neighbourhoods. I'm your host, Sidhu Dwar, account director at Consilio, where I work with London's developers, built environment consultants, councils and communities to bring better places to life. I'm joined today by Ibrahim. Ibrahim, welcome.
Thank you, sir.
Ibrahim is Managing Director of Portland Design and one of the UK's most influential voices on human-centred placemaking and future-ready retail. Ibrahim's journey is as unique as his perspective, starting with a degree in mechanical and aeronautical studies and production engineering from Kingston Polytechnic, followed by a master's in industrial design from the Royal College of Art and a diploma from Imperial College London. That combination and technical rigour and creative vision has shaped a career spanning more than three decades. Under his leadership, Portland has evolved from a traditional retail design agency into a global strategic consultancy delivering projects from community-led neighbourhoods in Elephant and Castle to wayfinding transformations at King's Cross Cold Drops Yard, which I can't wait to talk about, to reimagining the passenger experience in airport and aircraft hubs around the world. He's also the honorary president at Cardiff University Welsh School of Architecture, author of Future Ready Retail, and is working on a second book focused on community-led placemaking. In our conversation, we'll explore the big ideas behind creating places people love, how rapid change is rewriting the rules, and why the most important places, the most successful places today, are measured not just in footfall, but in the connection experience and a sense of belonging. You trained in aeronautical engineering and industrial design before moving into the retail and place strategy space. Can you tell some of our listeners how that shift happened and how it shaped your approach to design?
Yeah. After completing my postgrad industrial design studies at the Royal College of Art, I got a job in the consultancy and in design consultancy, and I was an industrial designer for a few years. And one day my boss asked me to join another project team, which was a retail team, designing at that time the first open plan bank. So I was
open plan bank.
Yeah,
please do elaborate on.
As in, no more bandit screens. So open plan, as you see now. I mean, that was revolutionary in those days. Mm. So it was for TSB at the time, and I got involved in that, and that introduced me to the world of retail and the language of brand and marketing. And then I went on actually to do the Institute of Marketing kind of qualifications to kind of retrain in marketing, and really got into brand strategy, retail, and eventually kind of found myself in doing more and more strategy and kind of insights and getting involved in and getting a big interest into kind of future trends and what were the cultural shifts that are informing the changes we were experiencing and driving those changes. And by the time we got into the 2000s, we were realizing how much people's relationship with brands and retail was changing, and how that was changing the complexion of our high streets, of our town centres. And we saw that really sort of 20 years ago. And we felt that, and you mentioned it in your introduction, we felt that that demanded a pivot in the business from a roster of clients who were retailers and brands to really focusing, as well as on that, but focusing on retail's impact on the built environment in terms of assets. So whether those assets are shopping centres or high streets or developments or airports or railway stations, how are these changes in retail, i.e. ground level activation, how are they impacting these places? And of course, the subject on everyone's lips since then has been the dying high street. And that's what I really got passionate about. And more recently, over the last 5 or 6 years, I'm getting more interested in the impact we have socially and culturally, as well as and environmentally, as well as commercially. So I absolutely believe that if we resolve the issue or address the issue of social value, cultural value, that will lead to commercial value. And I think that is a kind of very interesting lens through which to look at what the future of our town centres are and the future of our shopping centres.
Indeed, and it's a quite a cardinal indeed, and it's quite an important perspective that you bring to this conversation. And I really wanted to just unpack one of the first things that you said there, because I think for a layperson to just walk into the high street bank, they may not fully recall what they were like back then. I wonder what informed that decision. Was it a sense of qualitative and quantitative data, or focus groups, or was it just a thought that perhaps if people want access to their own money, they should feel comfortable in the spaces that they're in?
Yeah, we're talking about 1989, 1990. That's when I worked on that project. And it was definitely informed by this whole idea of humanising banking, humanising that relationship with people. Ironically, it's gone the other way more recently with technology. Well, exactly, but in those days, where there were a plethora of high street banks, is how do you get closer to people? How do you remove the barriers? Technology allowed the banks to be, at that time, secure. And that was a pioneering thing to be able to do in those days. And you know, we saw that from that time, the idea of retail being increasingly about experience.
Well, you want to create places that people love, right? I mean, that's absolutely one of your credos, or at least my research around your consultancy. Yeah. It's about unlocking the power of place.
And creating a place that is human. And I absolutely believe that any architecture that's not human-centric is irrelevant. And we've got to create places that are human in every respect, in terms of scale, in terms of the mix, in terms of the environment, in terms of materials, absolutely everything. And I think the mix, how you create the activation and what that activation is very much the key to creating a place that it resonates with its locality, with its community, and therefore is humanized. And that is an antidote to a cookie cutter approach to retail and our public realm. Yeah.
And before we started filming, we got into a conversation about one of my favorite places in London, but somewhere that I'd only discovered by accident. And that was due to, I think it were, it must have been a staff party that we had down there, Cold Drops Yard.
Yeah.
Please tell us a bit more about that project for those who perhaps haven't discovered it yet. And I use the word discovered intentionally, because it's, you know, before we got started talking, I admitted, and I probably still do, I find it so difficult to find. It's, if you exited from King's Cross, you just wouldn't know it was there.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, let me start by saying King's Cross and Cold Drops Yard are an incredible development and a very, very important, far-reaching idea that is a wonderful part of London, transformed London, and I think it's an amazing piece of regeneration. It has its challenges, particularly Cold Drops Yard had its challenges. I think in its fabric, in its architectural treatment, it's beautiful.
Oh, it's stunning!
Yeah, and in its kind of regeneration of what was there is really incredible. And it's, but I think it has a challenge, in as much as you come out the station, you don't know where it is. So that's a wayfinding issue. But once you're in the heart of the overall King's Cross development, i.e. in Granary Square, you know, it is quite difficult to be able to draw footfall into Coldrops Yard from Granary Square because it's not naturally connected.
Which is the perennial problem, I think, for any retailer, especially in, who's operating now. And I wonder, what's the challenge that's posed to you when a retailer comes to you and says, I have a slightly obscure location that, in which I'm developing, and I'm bringing forward something that is as great as Coldrops Yard, and we will touch on Elephant Castle and some of the work that Get Living did there. How do you approach thinking about wayfinding and making that experience human?
Well, first of all, you've got to understand who the audience are and what motivates them and what their, not just their journeys, but their missions. What are they there for? And understanding that very, very intimately and really getting under the skin of that and mapping those journeys, mapping the missions onto that space is the beginnings of wayfinding. But wayfinding is not just about navigation and orientation. Wayfinding is brand expression. Wayfinding is public realm, you know. So the strategy of it, what is the overall story of this, what we're trying to achieve here beyond allowing people to know where they are and where they want to go. So that's the kind of first thing is that kind of very strategic kind of definition. And then really understanding where are the key portals, where are the key touch points, where are the key decision points, how do you step stone people across a space, across a development. If you're in Granary Square, how do you step stone people from Granary Square to Coldrops Yard? You know, these are all very important issues. And once you're in any development, what's the scale like? How far are the shops? How warm is the public realm? How much does it feel human? How much do you want to just hang out there? Can you hang out there without spending your money? Because that's a big part of it.
That's the London challenge.
That's what you want to do. You want to be able to hang out there because it's just a great place to be. And of course, believe me, you will then spend money.
Oh, yeah,
but if you don't feel comfortable just being in a place, because it's either too cold, too high, too long, too wide, you know, too hard, whatever, then no amount of shops will encourage you to dwell, to linger. And therefore, you know, you won't spend. So I think that's part of it. The other part of it is the mix, of course, and the adjacencies of that mix, and not making things which are all premium or all F&B or all fashion or, you know, something which is like almost like an obsession. I think is getting the mix right, and how do you change the pace of that mix and change the pace of that environment to keep it interesting. But fundamentally, at a very fundamental level, people got to know where they are, where they want to go, and how they get there, and when they've arrived, you know, all those fundamental wayfinding kind of components. So it's a mixture of a whole bunch of things, really. And because we're not wayfinding specialists, but wayfinding is only one part of what we do, we're also place strategists and master planners. We always look at that, the wayfinding, in the context of the bigger picture. And that's important.
And what was the bigger picture when it came to Elephant Castle? Because it's often described as, and I think it's a great example of a really vibrant neighbourhood that's been created there, especially at a ground level. Yeah, how do you balance the commercial objectives with building real community connections?
I mean, in our case, we inherited a development which was already designed, so the architecture was there, the kind of concept was there. But what we believe absolutely is, in terms of answering your question, is how do you create a development that's permeable, that's open, that doesn't turn its back to its community, it opens to the community, it looks out to the community, and doesn't create a hermetically sealed box that looks in. I think that's sort of the fundamentals. But I think also, you know, it's not about just having amenity for all the people that live in the towers. It's about creating a destination for London. And that the authenticity and the truism of that place and that destination. It's about its community. It's about its Latino community, its Colombian community, you know, its Afro-Caribbean community, its whole mix of different ethnicities, along with its indigenous community, you know. So I think that brings the essence of it. I don't think, and I don't like actually, although I use it, I actually don't like the term placemaking. We're not here and we're not arrogant enough to believe we can make anything. We're not here to make place or, God forbid, impose place. We're here to help seed place, to help keep place, to shape place with some very important decisions. And I think how you seed it, what are the first things you do, and how you ensure that the community you're engaging with is fully collaborative, has fully collaborated in that process.
Could you give us an example of where you think that you've really effectively seeded the kind of foundations of what makes a good place?
I mean, in the case of Elephant and Castle, the kind of fundamental sort of strategic thinking was driven by this idea of discovering the jewels. Because if you look at the master plan, Elephant Castle isn't just a square, you know. It's a central piece, but it has a whole bunch of arteries, a whole bunch of side streets and smaller areas that kind of you discover from that central plaza. Whether they are the arches, whether it's a discovery of Elephant Park, whether in the future it'll be discovering going west to phase three, which is where the LCC is now, whether it's looking at, you know, Woolworth Road and how you bleed into Woolworth Road. There's a whole bunch of kind of this sort of ecosystem of different types of space, different scales of space. Some of them new, some of them old, some of them, you know, made of old brick, some of them are polished, you know, highly, highly, highly kind of finished kind of materials. And how you kind of, therefore, within that blend familiar brands and offers with local independent offers, and how you blend that, and how you kind of create these journeys of discovery to discover these jewels, which only can be found in Elephant Castle. That was the idea. But of course, within that, of course, we've got to have some familiar national players, because I think that's part of feeling comfortable. That's part of humanizing. I'm here, and I know there's something familiar. I know what I'm going to get and how much it's going to cost me, and that is important, particularly if I live upstairs, you know. But you've got to blend that. And you can't put smaller, interesting, independent brands just in tertiary spaces. You've got to blend it all in so it works together, both horizontally and vertically. So they're the principles, really.
And I have to say, it's really quite fascinating. I wonder, in terms of your international work, especially some of these airport hubs that you created, I think it's no secret that airlines serve particular transport hubs, and whether it's, I know if you're flying to Asia, you may cross through either Dubai or Abu Dhabi airports, but there's also Schiphol Airport, which is famous for its massive placemaking. Your airport work spans the commercial planning and passenger experience. How is designing an airport different from perhaps designing spaces for cities?
Yeah, it's a searching question. It's a very interesting question, and it's a very important question if you're dealing with airports, because, as I said, everything we do starts with our audience. Our mantra is people and places, not buildings and spaces. So we've got to really understand our audience. And one fundamental truism is that when you are traveling in an airport, most people, when they're traveling in an airport, they have a very different mindset. They have a very different state of mind. On the one hand, often they are excited. Adrenaline
not just
driven.
For the end destination, but you want to know what you can discover whilst you're there.
Yeah, right. Totally. You know, they're excited, they're adrenaline driven, as I say. They're kind of anticipating something. They're also stressed.
Mm.
It, by and large, you know, they're in unfamiliar territory, unfamiliar environment. So there's this kind of a contradiction that's happening. And therefore, they, when it comes to shopping, they behave in quite an unusual way. You know, drinking a pint of Guinness at 7 in the morning, you're not going to do that when you're normally at home.
I wouldn't say I'm guilty of that whatsoever. but it is fascinating. Oh, do you know, a friend of mine has a real tendency to suggest, in fact, insist that we have Nando's, especially if it's an early morning flight. And I've often said to them, one, I don't tend to eat breakfast, well, at least not anymore, my intermittent fasting, but whose idea was it to place Wetherspoons, Nando's or so at some of these airports? And of course, London's Heathrow is such a massive hub, serves millions and tens of millions of people each year. What goes into the mindset of some of these commercial operators, these airport giants, to think this is a great idea?
Because it works.
Indeed. Well, it does. I've answered my own question.
Because it works. And that's what people want. You know, and you can see every airport globally has got a McDonald's, got a Burger King or KFC or whatever. You know, that's what people want. And there's other stuff as well, mm-hmm. You know. I mean, at a personal level, I'm not a fan. I don't eat that.
What's your choice? What's your choice if you arrived in the airport in the morning and then perhaps in the later afternoon even?
In the morning, yes, you know, it's a croissant and a coffee, you know. But I actually really like Wagamamas. You know, when I'm in an airport, if there's a Wagamamas, I would do that.
The soups.
Yeah, they're great. You know, they're quite healthy. Yeah, they're good. They're good. Yeah. Mm.
And of course, your work internationally crosses both Europe, Middle East, but also Asia. Which project best kind of illustrates Portland's global perspective and some of your adaptability?
Interesting question. I mean, I suppose internationally, what we're known for, the kind of seminal project that we did was the Sadia Island in Abu Dhabi, mm-hmm. where the Guggenheim is planned and the Louvre is Sheikh Zayed Museum. So it's a museum kind of quarter.
Mm.
I say Guggenheim is planned. I think it's open now. It's a 27 square kilometer island, brand new developments of housing, commercial, leisure, retail, whole thing. Originally it was seven districts. A whole bunch of architects working all these different buildings and districts. And we were there to kind of look at the ground level strategy and master plan across all the districts, across all the architects. So we kind of set the strategy and with the glue, if you like, that held all that together at the ground level. And so that was and with all the wayfinding as well and the brand of the island. So that was a pretty seminal project for us, and it kind of catapulted the business in many ways.
What are you most proud of in some of the design work that you did across those initially seven districts?
Oh, I think the and this was quite a while ago, but the strategy that kind of defined a future of retail and how retail will impact. Because don't forget, we were doing this before there was any spades on the ground.
Do you think in the Middle East or perhaps inform work across the globe?
Totally. I mean, the audience for Sadia Island is completely international. But, you know, those days we were talking about the ground level not just being retail, and really blending with a whole bunch of other kind of offers around leisure, entertainment, culture, healthcare, learning, all the experiential kind of offers blended with retail and food. Mm. And that was kind of very early days of thinking in those ways. But yeah, it was a very interesting project and a really large-scale project, and I would say very challenging as well. But it's really good to see it gradually come to life.
And obviously, on a foundational level, I think in Future Ready Retail, thank you so much for the book, by the way.
You're welcome.
sent across to us. You write about places as kind of media platforms.
Yeah.
How does that idea challenge traditional property valuation models? Like, what is the concept?
Right. Okay. That's a it's a good question.
I'd like to keep our guests on their feet here because it's all about thought leadership and a good insight. But it was a concept that I was quite fascinated by. Is it?
As you asked me a question, I'm trying to think, where do I start with this? Do I go right to first principles? Let's start by just saying a truism. Basically, retail has always been, will always be, only about four things: recruitment, transaction, fulfillment, and retention. Find the customer.
Basic principles of business.
Yeah. Find a customer, sell them something, get it to them, and encourage them to come back. What's interesting is that transaction and fulfillment is increasingly migrating online. So the physical space, let's not call it a shop anymore, the physical space, therefore, if it's, look, first of all, I'm generalizing. And secondly, I'm being a little bit provocative because it's a podcast and because I wrote it in the book. But, you know, by and large, you know, we've been speaking about this for at least 10 years. And you can see the trend gradually, albeit slowly, but gradually going that way. By and large, more and more retailers are transacting and fulfilling more and more of their products online. So increasingly, retail space will be used more and more for recruitment and retention to drive people online. And online increasingly also meaning social media. So if that's the case, the issue isn't, I don't think, the issue isn't whether it's the case, actually. It's just the speed and the proportion. Of any given asset, how much of that space will be for transaction and fulfillment, and how much of a space will be for recruitment and retention? In other words, if a brand takes a space, occupies a space to recruit and retain, it means they're behaving like a media platform. They're treating that physical space.
It's a showroom. It's
like media.
Yeah,
exactly. But the shift is not that. Showrooming has been around for a long time. It's not about the showrooming. Because the question was about revenue. And the revenue of a showroom is a traditional revenue. You pay by how much space you've got. You can't pay by turnover because you're not turning over anything. But you pay by how much space you've got. But this is a different paradigm.
You know, it's not always that you read something in a book and then you can speak to the author about it. I was reading the concept and I thought it was so fascinating. Please continue. Yeah.
So the issue is, the difference is this. So if we have, I'm a brand and I take a space, and I want to use that space for recruitment and retention. So how am I going to measure the value of that space to me? And more importantly, how is the asset owner going to measure the value to the brand? In other words, how am I going to get rent from it? Is it per square meter? Well, if I'm a really, really cool brand and I really know what I'm doing, I could create something really compelling that people will photograph and share and talk about. In other words, it create media impressions in one square meter. So the value of it is not about how many square meters it is. It's about its ability to drive media impressions that are shareable. But very importantly, it's not just about how it can drive media impressions. From a landlord perspective, from an asset owner's perspective, it's about how you can attribute that media impression to that space. The attribution of it is the key. And if we can attribute to whatever happens there at any time to all the media impressions it drives, the followership, the shares, the tweets, the whatever, then the challenge is how do you put a value to those, a monetary value? Oh, yeah. So if a brand spends $1, which is kind of average, on a Facebook click, how much is a brand willing to pay for half an hour of undivided attention of a fan?
Indeed.
So you're moving now in that paradigm.
I mean, at this point, most clips I see nowadays are about 30 seconds long, but I'm even seeing increasingly clips about 16 seconds for political clips I'm watching. Yeah. If I'm on TikTok, if I ever fall into that rabbit hole for 20 minutes a day, it's instant.
Yeah, absolutely. But what I'm saying is that, therefore, how much am I willing to pay for that attention, if the landlord can attribute it to what's happening into that in that
also
space,
driving footfall to their asset,
and it's driving footfall to their asset, of course. But very importantly, suddenly, if you're a brand doing that, you're no longer dealing with consumers. Mm. It's not about consumers, and the holy grail of a brand in a retail context and in every other context is to develop fandom. So it's about fandom, and that's the shift.
Wow,
it's about really understanding how we can capture the data that is geolocated, in other words, attributed to that physical space, that proves that that data, that media impression it was driven from that experience. And then we put a monetary value to it. But then you turbo boost it, because if that experience is so compelling and it's live streamed, suddenly your audience, your fandom, isn't place or time dependent. Then anyone can tune into that live stream, whatever the experience is. So suddenly your audience, if you're an asset owner, if you're a shopping center or high street, your potential audience isn't the people that just are present at that time. And that's where the real value comes. Now, when it comes to an asset, when it comes to a town centre, a high street, a shopping centre, an airport, whatever, the question, as I say, is not whether that's going to happen. In fact, it is happening already. You see it in China absolutely exploding, this social commerce driven by live streaming. In other words, commerce through content.
Hmm.
So that whole content commerce through social media is really critical. But the key is that... I lost my thread now. I was going to say something. We said about live streaming. I've lost the thread. But it was one other point I was going to make, and it was about the live streaming. Ah, yes. Okay. So the key is, if I'm an asset owner, if I own a high street, if I'm a town centre, a shopping centre, airport, whatever. The key is not whether that's going to happen.
Mm.
The key is, in the master plan, what proportion of my occupiers are transacting and fulfilling, and what proportion are treating that that space as a media platform. Now, what's interesting, as that proportion, the balance shifts and there's more and more media space, that changes everything. If a brand takes a space to as a media, it shifts everything. It changes the whole paradigm, the design of the space, the service proposition, the technology, the architecture, the master plan, how it connects to public realm. It's now more open cell. It's more like a stage than a shop.
And do you know which company I think does that really well? Apple.
Yes, of course.
Their stores are incredible. I mean, not only are they architecturally impressive, but the way that they blend even with the pavement. It's as if you're seamlessly stepping into this world that you can easily either purchase it there, or it can also just be a place where you're interacting with the technology.
And doesn't matter whether you purchase it there or online. They don't care. I mean, absolutely.
And their profits and their revenue prove it. So we talked a bit about responding to kind of rapid social and technological change, but how do you think that your work, without giving away any kind of trade secrets, can see into the shifts that are coming, particularly in retail? How are you... is it that there are some cardinal human traits that you know will be constant, or are there trends that are often here with us now that you can see coming down the track?
Yeah, all of those things. But I mean, we have a foresight team headed by my colleague Elisa, and we also have a data analytics team headed by my colleague Paddy. And yeah, their expertise is exactly that. It's identifying the key cultural trends, looking at the big societal, first off, looking at the big societal shifts, the cultural shifts that are kind of on the horizon that we believe will have an impact. And that's Elisa sort of does that and articulates that and storifies it, if you like. And Paddy really kind of looks at that in terms of how it might impact the data from that, how it might impact the built environment and what we're doing in commercial terms and also in social value terms. These guys are absolute sort of experts in cultural intelligence and insights and trend forecasting and analysis. But certainly we don't sort of just look at kind of technology trends or things that are kind of buzzy at the moment. We try to look at more long-term cultural shifts, and you can begin to see the kind of geopolitical and social cultural shifts that are beginning to happen, and this sort of polarization, this idea of this kind of epidemic we have in loneliness, healthcare issues. There's a whole bunch of things that are really beginning to shift people's mindset, particularly young people, and we're very interested in all that. And I think fundamental change is not really to do with design or architecture or the built environment. It's to do with a shift in the relationship people have with brands and place. That relationship is shifting. Mm. And there's a famous journalist called Gillian Tett who writes for The Times. Mm. And she talks about something very interesting. I've got her book, but I can't remember the name of the book. But she talks about this shift from vertical trust to horizontal trust. From vertical trust to lateral trust. And vertical trust is about trust in institutions, trust in government, trust in big brands. This is declining. The lack of trust in faceless businesses. And there's more and more trust, growing trust in lateral trust in people's peer groups, in micro influences, in small brands, in localism, in their local community. So this shift is really interesting and it has a big impact. And this is a kind of typical cultural shift that we kind of map and track. And those signals, that, as we call them, are things that we really kind of focus on and try to translate and project them and how they might impact our clients and some of the work we're doing.
Thank you. That's deeply interesting. I'll certainly take a look at it myself. And it's a good segue into
just before
closing
you carry,
section.
Just to finish off, so I forgot to say, so we have something called From the Future with Love, which is a LinkedIn kind of newsletter and on our website. And a lot of this is much more long form, but that's where we talk about it.
Yeah, always up for reading. I've actually said that something that some organisations, consultants kind of neglect to understand is actually London is a city of readers. And we certainly do love any insight that we can find. And I know that there's a kind of proliferation of podcasts and video content. Always love a good read. So yeah. I'll be sure to subscribe. And on Goodreads, you're working on your second book.
I am.
This time focus on...
Thank you very much.
Right. Yeah. This time focused on community place making, or indeed a kind of alternative term. Can you share any early themes or kind of provocations from that work?
Yeah. First thing to say, I'm writing it with my son, so I'm a co-author, which has been really quite an amazing experience, as you could imagine. And the book really explores the intersection between brands, place, and culture, and how brands must now increasingly be connected to the culture of common interest. and how that's going to impact the places that those brands frequent or those brands occupy. And what impact will that have on our on places, on the activation of place, the vibrancy of place, the connection to community of place. And in fostering this idea of connection to culture and driving community through brands, how can that impact a drive social value and impact social value kind of criteria? Could that kind of what I've just described, could that impact sort of community cohesion, healthcare outcomes, meaningful employment, intergenerational connection and fairness, a whole bunch of things. So we absolutely believe that if you get in any given place, if you create a strategy which has the right type of occupiers, the right type of mix that drives content, it's not about architecture, it's about content. The architecture is a byproduct of understanding what the content is, i.e. the activation content. How does that drive community? And how is that content and community connected and aligned to culture? And what are the cultures that it's aligned to? And the fourth C of place shaping, I prefer to call it, is co-creation. You can't do that without co-creating it with community, with your audience, and I don't call them consumers, with the citizens that have a stake in this. So those four C's of place shaping are fundamentally what the book is built around. And of course, as you could imagine, a lot of that is manifested in the digital world, in the virtual world. So it's been great fun writing it with my son. He's very good, and I've learned a lot from him, which is really kind of interesting. Yeah, I'm very proud to be able to have the opportunity to write it with him, and I'm very grateful to Kogan Page, who have given us the opportunity. They're great guys.
Thank you so much, and I'm certainly looking forward to reading through your next book. And as we close, one project you take a listener to if they really wanted to see Portland Design's ethos in action?
I mean, I could go back in history, but I think let's keep it more recent. Foundry, which is the co-working brand and offer for LNG. And do you want me to tell you the reason why?
Of course.
I think it really is, it's quite pioneering, and it points to the future of, albeit it's about co-working, of course it's a co-working offer, but it's interesting how co-working is being treated and looked upon like retail. So it sits at the ground level in a shopping centre.
Do they have
center.
One in Oval? Am I mistaken?
No, they don't. The ones we did, the initial ones, and there's more and more of them now, but we did the Beacon in Eastbourne, which is a shopping centre, the Dolphin in Poole, which is a shopping centre, and in Walthamstow, a BTR development. But what's a built-to-rent development. But what's interesting is how co-working isn't, in this case, you know, isn't a kind of this sort of hermetically sealed kind of a unit that kind of has no connectivity. The whole ethos of Foundry is that it connects to its community. It is outward looking, and it can, and very importantly, it activates public realm. It catalyzes retail and F&B, and it becomes a key anchor in an asset. Co-working is not. And I, in some ways, think that the industry has got this wrong. Big, large parts of the industry has got this wrong in terms of co-working. Co-working is not just another office. Co-working, and this is where understanding of the cultural trends that are driving this change. Co-working is a response to a dip-in, dip-out culture of work where we weave work increasingly into our daily lives. Mm. So co-working can't be seen, you know, in an office block. I don't believe that is actually kind of authentic co-working. Co-working is something that sits with retail at the ground level, catalyzes retail, becomes public realm activating, and really, really drives a kind of community cohesion.
Thank you so much, Ibrahim, for your time. And I think it's been one of our more, honestly, one of our more fascinating conversations that we've had. So that's it for today's episode of the Best Places podcast. My thanks to Ibrahim again for a fascinating and inspiring conversation from the micro details of human scale design to the bigger picture of how we value and create places in a fast changing world. I'm Sadu Dwyer. Thanks again for the time and for listening. If you enjoy this podcast, please subscribe and please share it with someone who's passionate about place shaping, and join me next time as we uncover more stories and strategies for building better places for everyone.